This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. troops withdrew from their largest base in northern Syria Sunday. Meanwhile, the debate over the possible reemergence of the Islamic State group continues. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
Now that American troops will be leaving Syria, some members of Congress continue to be concerned about a comeback by the Islamic State group. Democrat Bob Menendez is the ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
The Department of Defense Inspector General tells us there are still 18,000 ISIS fighters in Syria. If the 10,000 that have been detained by the Kurds get released, that's a potential fighting force of hardened fighters of 30,000. To me, that's a clear and present danger to the United States.
But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo disagrees.
I'm very confident that this administration's efforts to crush ISIS will continue.
Both Pompeo and Menendez appeared on ABC's This Week. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Police and protesters exchanged tear gas and petrol bombs as illegal march on Sunday descended into chaos in Hong Kong. David Doyle with Reuters.
Police and protesters exchanged tear gas and petrol bombs on Sunday as Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement staged an illegal anti-government march through the city's Kowloon district. That demonstration attracted tens of thousands onto the streets and descended into chaos, with hundreds of shops trashed and Chinese banks and metro stations targeted. After 2 weeks of relative calm, Sunday's protest shows that the movement has not lost support. Protesters erected flaming barricades on Nathan Road, a major Kowloon retail strip, and threw petrol bombs at a nearby police station. The police responded with tear gas, some of the heaviest use of water cannon the protests have seen, and by driving through barricades.
And that is Reuters' David Doyle, and this is VOA News. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper sought a first-hand assessment Sunday of the U.S. military's future role in Afghanistan, stalled peace talks with the Taliban, and unrelenting attacks by the insurgent group and Islamic State militants have complicated the Trump administration's pledge to withdraw more than 5,000 American troops. Esper says that the U.S. can reduce its force in Afghanistan 8,600 without hurting the counterterrorism fight, but he said any withdrawal would happen as part of a peace agreement with the Taliban. At least six civilians and three soldiers are said to have died during cross-border skirmishes between Pakistani and Indian troops late on October 19th. This makes it one of the deadliest days since New Delhi revoked the special status of Indian-administered Kashmir in August. Indian Army Chief told reporters that his forces destroyed terror camps inside neighboring Pakistan in a retaliatory attack against militants based in Pakistan. There's a murder trial happening in Nicaragua for a crime committed in upstate New York. The suspect has dual citizenship. AP correspondent Julie Walker explains.
It's a rare legal scenario, but not unprecedented. Authorities say Binghamton University student Orlando Tercero strangled fellow student Haley Anderson last year and then fled to Nicaragua. She was found dead in his bed, and prosecutors say Tercero left a note saying, "I'm sorry." He's a dual citizen of both countries, and Nicaragua rejected an extradition request from the U.S. So Tercero's being tried in a court in Nicaragua, with witnesses testifying from upstate New York via live stream with the help of a translator. Julie Walker, New York.
Australian Airlines Qantas landed the world's first ultra-long-haul research flight in Sydney Sunday after traveling 16,200 kilometers from New York. Edward Barron.
It's the ultimate in long-haul flights. Australian airline Qantas have tested out a non-stop journey from New York to Sydney, lasting nearly 20 hours and spanning more than 16,000 kilometers or just over 10,000 miles. The idea was to research how the world's longest commercial airplane journey would impact pilots, crew and passengers. Qantas CEO Alan Joyce.
This is a really historic moment for Qantas, a really historic moment for Australian aviation and a really historic moment for world aviation.
With demand for air travel rapidly growing and aircraft performance improving, carriers are increasingly looking into ultra-long-haul travel.
That's Reuters' Edward Barron reporting. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Money Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says it is not possible to form a unity government by November 12.
All my chairman is saying, let's implement this agreement in letter and in spirit. And let us not build the house from the roof. Let's start it from the best as we go to the roof.
And African leaders are meeting again in this week in Sochi, Russia. Tim Jonah is a former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
I think that for the Africans, it opens a lot of options not to rely only on one power.
And obstacles to abortion and extramarital affairs in Morocco. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar says it is not possible to form a unity government by the November 12 deadline. Machar made the comments after he and President Salva Kiir met on Sunday in Juba with a visiting United Nations Security Council delegation. The council wants the two leaders to form the unity government by November 12. But Machar said South Sudan could return to another civil war if a unity government is formed on November 12. Paul Khan is a member of the SPLM-IO National Pre-Transitional Committee. He says the SPLM-IO is concerned about incomplete security arrangements as well as the number of states. He says the SPLM-IO wants to see a security that is national, not tribal.
On the 3rd of May this year, we did extend it the free transitional period simply because there were critical tasks outlined in the agreement, which were not accomplished, that we must meet those tasks before the formation of the government. And that is to say, the security arrangement, there must be necessary unified force in place for us to have a unity government in place. That has not been made. And our chairman did outline the fact that even if you form the unity government, it will not serve the people of South Sudan. The people of South Sudan want to see a security that is pro-people, a security that is national in nature, an army that is national in nature, a police that is national in nature. Not tribal army, not tribal security, not a tribal police. So all my chairman is saying, let's implement this agreement in letter and in spirit. And let us not build the house from the roof. Let's start it from the best as we go to the roof. The second that he didn't mention is the number of states. The number of states is one of the issues that caused the 2016. We are not ready as SPLM-IO to go into a government that will be busy renegotiating the agreement.
Mr. Khan, what do you think the members of the Security Council, what was their reaction? Because I'm looking at a quote here from the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations saying that the council was disappointed by your chairman's comments.
Well, I don't think my chairman has made anything wrong. Instead, he was honest as to how the situation is on the ground. And he wanted the council to come to the rescue of our people. And let me give you an example, Jenny. Without the security arrangement in place, those people who are in the POC, that is the protection site for IDP, those people who are in the refugee camp will not return home. What will be the price of our people if they could not trust their own security? So I don't see why the ambassador should be disappointed. In a sense, the ambassador should be happy for the Soviet being honest to us or to the council. But we are committed to the implementation of this agreement in both letter and spirit, and that we would not want to work outside the agreement.
South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makui says that there has been no change in the schedule. As far as the government in Juba is concerned, there should be a transitional government by November 12.
That is their position. But they must also be informed that they are working against the agreement. When we extended the period, they pledged to fund the agreement by at least $100 million. We did not realize that up to today. Instead, they decided not to fund the activities of the security arrangement. They are the reason why today we are talking about the security arrangement. So they should also be mindful of their responsibilities when they're talking of the 12th or November by passing the agreement. They should be mindful of what it takes when you form a government that is not inclusive in nature.
Paul Khan is a member of the SPLM-IO National Pre-Transitional Committee. He was speaking with us from the South Sudan capital, Juba. About 35 African leaders will meet this week at the first ever Africa-Russia Economic Summit in the Black Sea resort town of Sochi. Some analysts say the summit will help Russia provide its Soviet-era relationships with African leaders, while also aiming to provide new markets in Africa to replace other global customers that were lost as a result of U.S. and European sanctions on Russian companies. James Jonah is the former U.N. Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. He says the summit will provide an opportunity for African countries not to rely on one superpower.
I think that for the Africans, it opens a lot of options not to rely only on one power, not Japan alone, not China alone, not the European Union alone, but also options with Russia. It allows them to have a flexible foreign policy. For Russia, I think that they must be entering this after very careful analysis.
Dr. Jonah, unlike the United States before recently, the issue of human rights used to be at the forefront of U.S. foreign policies. What do you think that the issue of human rights may not play prominently in Russia-Africa relations?
I don't take these criticism from Western countries very seriously, because people forget that until President Carter became the president of the United States, neither U.S. nor the Europeans focus on the issue of human rights. In fact, when Carter talked about human rights, they felt that, why are you doing that? No, I think it doesn't make too much of a sense. The fact that they talk about human rights doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean they solve the human rights problem. Because if I were running an African country and I hear some saying you don't observe human rights, I will say, but what about your country? To what extent do you resolve human rights problems in your country? And there you find it doesn't make any sense.
It seems to me more and more African countries are turning towards the East, China, and now Russia. What's the role of the United States?
Well, it is not the African fault. Most Africans really would prefer to have good relations with the United States. People forget that at the beginning of the African struggle for independence, they looked to America, and America gave strong support to African countries. But they cannot say it now. So it is not their fault. If you listen to the speech that President Trump gave at the UN, he hardly mentioned Africa. So why should the Africans, what could they do if the interest is not that great on the other side? I think that they would like to, but maybe at a working level in the State Department, yes, but not from the executive office in the White House.
Dr. Jonah, I look forward to speaking with you more on Daybreak Africa.
Okay, thank you very much.
James Jonah is the former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. You're speaking with us from New York City. Today is Monday, October 21st, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. It's Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni really finishing his political opposition. Stephen Kafiro is a journalist with the Ugandan Monitor. In his latest article, he argues that aside from the ever-present state coercion and the narrowing political space, a critical look at the opposition since the 2016 presidential election shows the disorganization, infighting, defeats, lack of strategy, defection, and betrayal.
President Museveni, sometime in 2015, made very interesting declaration against the opposition. He said, to paraphrase him, that the opposition by 2021, which is the next election cycle, would be finished. And so I look back at the events that have been happening and 4 years since he got a new mandate, and it would appear his prophecy, his declaration, if you want to call it that, is taking shape. And so we thought with my editors that's something that would, you know, cause a discussion right about now.
But Stevens, some would argue that President Museveni himself is the problem because of the way he treats the opposition. He uses violence.
Absolutely. I would think that is not in doubt. But also the opposition has questions to ask of itself. Because the repression is not new. It has been around, if you want, since 1986 when President Museveni took power. The first violence, the first repression. But if you look back about 5-6 years ago and what was happening then and what is happening now, you get a sense that he's finally having an upper hand. I mean, it might be too early to predict, but that's what it looks.
You write, Stephen, that away from the ever-present state coercion and the narrowing political space, what emerges from a critical look at the opposition since the last general election is disorganization, infighting, defeats, lack of strategy. What do you think accounts for this, and what do you make of the emergence of, say, politicians like Bobby Wine?
Well, the defeats, if you look at the number of by-elections that have happened in the country, this is where the opposition used to really, really assert itself. In these by-elections, if you do the tally, it doesn't give a great picture. The NRM seems to be getting an upper hand. Whether it's getting it fairly, whether it's getting it genuinely, is a topic for another debate. I mean, Bobby Wine has emerged. He's an exciting candidate. And strangely, he has excited the quote-unquote the international community. But I've talked to people. I also, personally, I think he's not qualified. He still has some work to do, to go into the villages, to go into the communities, to organize, to put it together. I don't think Brian has both the capacity, but also the experience to really, really, really pull it off. But you see, you can't write him off. I mean, I think he's a very important contribution to the opposition. And if they can find a working method, all these groups, he, his group, his people power, and the way he has excited the youth, and then the traditional opposition, and all these other interests, if they can converge and put up what I think, then President Museveni will have a good run for his money.
Stephen Kafiru is a journalist with the Ugandan Monitor newspaper. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. Ugandan health officials are intensifying the fight against HIV/AIDS in the country. They say that although the prevalence has reduced over the years from more than 20% to 6%, there are still high levels of new infections and hundreds are also dying of the disease. Mugumi Davis Rakarinje reports from Kampala.
At least 1.4 million people are living with HIV/AIDS in Uganda, according to the Uganda AIDS Commission, a government body in charge of combating the spread of HIV/AIDS in the country. Vincent Bagambe, the director of planning, the Uganda AIDS Commission, says some members of the community are no longer worried of the disease simply because they know there are antiretroviral drugs.
Especially the young generation have developed complacency and they think they can live with HIV or they are no longer taking precautions to protect against HIV/AIDS.
Antiretroviral medication can help treat HIV by preventing it from targeting healthy cells. The drugs do not kill or cure the virus. However, they help prevent the growth of the virus and improves a patient's immunity. According to the United Nations Program on HIV and AIDS or UNAIDS, at least 1,000 people in the country get infected with HIV every week. This means that there are about 55,000 new infections each year in the country. Karusi Kiragu is the UNAIDS country director in Uganda. She says people must be reminded time and again that HIV/AIDS does not have cure.
HIV, in a way, has gone underground. It's not like before where you could see people who are skinny, you know, who are gaunt. Now everybody looks normal, and people can forget that it's among us. But for us, what we do in partnership with the government is to continue following the statistics and continue raising the alarm. Our point is that even if it's going down, it has not gone down enough.
In 2017, Uganda's President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni launched what is known as the Presidential Fast Track Initiative with the goal of ending HIV/AIDS by 2030. Esther Mbayo, the minister for the presidency, says the new campaign will aim at ensuring this presidential initiative becomes a reality.
We need to constantly remind our people that HIV is still with us and has no cure, and that Everyone should do whatever it takes to avoid it.
She says the government and the health practitioners will embark on media campaign sensitizing communities on prevention measures as well as treatment for the disease. She also says the government will use this campaign to mobilize finances needed in the fight against HIV/AIDS. For VOA News, Ayamugume, Davis Rwakarinjini, Kampala, Uganda.
A report launched last week by the United Nations Development Program takes the unique approach of telling African migrants' stories through their own voices. Scaling Fences, Voices of Irregular African Migrants to Europe, explores the perspectives of African migrants from 39 countries who arrived in Europe through irregular routes. The report's author, Mohamed Yahya, spoke to Ricky Stryak about some of the findings.
Here you have a group of people who have really, rightly or wrongly, not something that they were involved in, have had a serious impact in political trajectory of Europe in the recent years. They're people that you hear about them, everybody talks about them, they're used in advertisements, and you don't hear anything from them. So their voice, their opinion, their perspective, their humanity, in a sense, was absent from the debate. And here we wanted to tell a story of what was the development conditions that is making these young people want to live and see Europe outside Africa as a place for them to achieve their dreams. And to do that, we wanted to do it scientifically as much as possible and get them to talk with the level of anonymity that they would require.
These irregular migrants who are arriving in Europe, they had jobs that were considered pretty good in a national context. Despite that, 38% of the respondents said they didn't earn enough to, quote, get by, and only 12% were able to save. How important is that?
I think the first point is to say that employment is needed in Africa, and there's a lot of people who are entering the job market. The latest figure is 33,000 Africans enter the job market every 24 hours are looking for jobs. That's a huge number, and that will increase. But what the report was touching on is using jobs as a disincentive for migration is not backed by evidence.
Let me clarify that. Using jobs in the home country.
Yeah, so the idea that just any job will stop people from migrating is not backed by evidence. I think it's really important we make a difference between people needing jobs. There are many people who need jobs, but any job as a tool for disincentivizing or making people stay in their own country is not backed by evidence. And this is what we are saying. That essentially, you're absolutely right. Significant percentages had jobs. They're earning between $300 to $500 a month. And the interesting part is even with that amount of money, they could not finance their own migration.
That was Mohamed Yahya, author of the recent United Nations report, Scaling Fences, Voices of Irregular African Migrants to Europe. You are speaking to Ricky Stryak from Abuja, Nigeria. Last week, Morocco's King Mohammed VI pardoned a journalist who had been sentenced to a year in prison for an alleged extramarital affair and abortion. Hajja Raisouni denied the charges, but her case highlighted the obstacles facing women in the country. Dunya Boris is a member of the collective Atsuo, who worked on women's health. She spoke with Ricky Stryak about the need to change abortion and extramarital sex laws that pertain to women in Morocco.
Well, it was great news for them and we're happy for them, but we cannot generalize that. But the laws still get applied on a daily basis.
Can you tell me what are those laws that are concerning for women's rights activists such as yourself?
We have two specific laws that are really, well, there are quite a few, but those two from the criminal law. One is against abortion. Either the one who practices it or give away to someone to get abortion, or they go to for a year or 2 years in prison. Second law is about sexual relationship outside of the band of marriage. So when there is an abortion and the couple isn't married, they get sentenced for both because of those two articles. So even if today Hajar, her partner, and her doctor have been released, the debate is still on. And at least we are happy that the debate is open, because before it was even impossible to talk about it. Like, if it was a horrible crime to do, just to have an open conversation about abortion and sexual relationship outside of marriage. So we finally can talk about this issue. We can hear about it in the radio all the time. It's a huge step forward, to be honest. And today, the most important thing is to maintain this momentum, to take advantage of it so we can get a proposition of law to get presented and voted in the parliament to change that situation.
What step are you at now in reaching that goal, in getting something in front of parliament to a vote?
Well, what we can do and what we're trying to do is, first of all, the classical moves, like to manifest, to write about it, to talk about it. And we're trying to contact some parliament people that we voted for to try to put pressure on the parliament to talk about that. The problem is how to, even when we have some parliamentary, to get to schedule the moment where we can talk and then vote for those laws. Schedule to vote for those laws has been scheduled for like 2 times before already, and postponed many times. So now we're trying to have another date.
Dunya Boris works on women's health. She was speaking to Ricky Schreier from Rabat, Morocco. Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting, here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Japan, where South African national rugby team shattered Japan's dream of reaching the World Cup semi-finals with a pulsating 26-3 victory in Tokyo on Sunday to set up a blockbuster last four clash with Wales. The Springboks took an early lead after some good work from Makozule Mapimpi, who touched down in the corner after 4 minutes of play, forcing his way past three Japanese defenders. The hosts responded in the 19th minute, converting a penalty kick to set the game up for some good rugby display from both sides. Rassie Erasmus is South Africa's rugby national team coach.
Yeah, sure. We are happy making the semi-finals. We were very nervous at halftime. I think the first half, overall, we were nervous going into this match, playing against Japan with their home support and the way they played against Ireland and Scotland, and they were definitely building momentum. But I think being together for 17 weeks, the guys knew which buttons to push to get ourselves out of that lull and come and produce it in the second half. So yeah, we're a bit proud of that. And now we're into the semi-finals and hopefully we can put it through.
In athletics news, world marathon record holder Eliud Kipchoge has once again made history by becoming the first sports personality to be awarded the highest Kenyan national honor for a civilian in the country. President Uhuru Kenyatta awarded Eliud Kipchoge with Elder of the Order of the Golden Heart of Kenya Award during National Mashujaa Day celebrations in Mombasa on Sunday. President Kenyatta, in his address to the country, urged Kenyans to emulate the world marathon record holder.
Eliud Kipchoge remains the greatest of our time, and our duty is to emulate this enviable level of discipline and determination in our pursuit for a better Kenya for all.
Eliud Kipchoge earlier this month became the first man to achieve the barrier-breaking sub-2-hour marathon as part of the iNews 159 challenge. And on to cricket news. Nigeria's senior national male cricket team will today take on Canada in their second Group B match at the ongoing T20 World Cup qualifiers in the United Arab Emirates. The Nigerian side on Saturday lost by 69 runs to Jersey in their first Group B match. In the match played at the Zaid Cricket Stadium in Abu Dhabi, Jersey post her highest score ever in the T20 cricket competition with 184 runs for the loss of 4 wickets. Nigeria, however, scored 115 runs for the loss of 7 wickets. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that is it for this Monday, October 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a productive week.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.